Someone in my family dreamed it. No one now remembers who. The dream stems from something that happened when we were living in the East, and so begins in what feels solidly fact-based and actual. Just back from a visit to Berkeley, we are stopping by the vets to pick up our dog from boarding. We are all there, my husband, my daughter, my son, and me, all in that state of high alert known as hypervigilance, all watching the door in the back of the waiting room. This is where the tech will appear, bringing our dog to us. But here the dreamscape warps, time tilts, everything starts to take too long, door opening, families standing, brought into slow-mo unison by their crazy love for this dog, an English Springer Spaniel named Whistler. Now, as the dog is being led by the tech across the broad expanse of tile floor, the dreamer begins to get that something's a little off, that the two keep coming but remain very far away, that this family's fake. Too loud, everyone saying false and scripted things. Hey, boy, there you are. We missed you, buddy. Come on. Come here. Good boy. Like they're all repeating lines of cartoon dialogue. Because this is not our dog. It only looks like him. A likeness in both appearance and behavior so uncanny that even the dog himself is fooled. As this dog, who is not our dog, comes wagging his no-tail rump at us, moving toward the strange family that now stands like a group of statues. Only the dreamer notices what no one else yet sees. That dog's a ringer. The dreamer wants to say, somehow knowing with a dreamer's spacious overview, how the mix-up came to be, that two look-alike dogs so similar they might be clones have been switched in the back in grooming. This is the wrong dog, the dreamer tries to say aloud to the tech. Our real dog's the one in back, but the dreamer is frozen and can't seem to get the words out and so must struggle again to speak as the tech keeps leading the dog, who is not our dog, across the waiting room. The dreamer's now saying it more and more urgently. Wrong dog. Wrong dog. But locked together in the paralysis of sleep, teeth, tongue, lips, all the muscles of the dreamer's face are stilled, so the words are slurred as they're said. Wrong dog! Wrong dog! So no one pays attention, and the dreamer now understands the true horror here. What seemed to start as this loving, joyful dream has just become a nightmare.
That was Jane Vandenberg reading the opening paragraphs of her recent memoir, The Wrong Dog Dream, A True Romance. I'm Suzanne Lang, and we'll listen to my conversation with Jane in just a moment. Then later in the broadcast, Rosemary Manchester talks with Kathleen Alcott about her debut novel, The Dangers of Proximal Alphabets. And Barbara Quick brings a review of Cheryl Strayed's memoir, Wild, From Lost to Found on the Pacific Crest Trail. I hope you'll stay with us. It's a novel idea. The tragic death of a beloved dog, the lifeline of a new one, and the finding of home with all its trip-ups and rewards is the territory of Jane Vandenberg's latest book, The Wrong Dog Dream, A True Romance. And romance of the human and canine sort abounds. Vandenberg is the author of several books of fiction and nonfiction and blogs for The Huffington Post. Her writing is easy and witty and engages as if she's talking with you. So let's listen to my conversation with Jane Vandenberg. Jane,
Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We're here today to talk about The Wrong Dog Dream, your latest book, a memoir, and a true romance. Mm-hmm. So we'll get to that in a minute, but some of our readers might not be familiar with your other work, and you have two works of fiction, two novels, Failure to Zigzag and The Physics of Sunset.
Right.
And then you've moved into the realm of nonfiction. So talk a little bit about that trajectory.
I have always worked right there at the cusp of fiction, nonfiction. I wrote an autobiographical first novel and then sort of semi-autobiographical second novel. I mean, there were certainly elements of myself and my characters. And I'm interested in these times of ours, particularly maybe the trajectory of women and girls over the second half of the 20th century. It's just been a phenomenally interesting time for me. I had a very upsetting and sort of atypical childhood in that I lost both my parents by the time I was 10 and was raised by an aunt and uncle. But then I found out in adulthood that that actually wasn't as abnormal as I believed it to be, that sort of broken family was not so odd. And so more and more, my work is about, I think, the way this completely atypical life of mine is actually resonant with many, particularly the women of my generation who've undergone such change. My first memoir is called A Pocket History of Sex in the 20th Century, a memoir. And I'm very proud of the title because it's actually about gender.
Uh-huh. And that explored a different period of your life than this one.
Yes. Yes. This book is the book that I was told I'd left out of the memoir. So I see it actually as three parts of one greater work, and actually all my work as the same story. I just tell it from different rooms of the same big house.
Well, some say we're all part of one big narrative, and that it makes sense that in your own work you see it that way.
Yeah.
And I just quickly want to mention your book, The Architecture of the Novel, that seems to be a tool for other writers. And we live in the Bay Area, which, you know, every third house or fourth house is a writer. And in between, there's maybe a poet, you know,
yeah,
and a painter yeah next door. What prompted you to go in that direction of writing that kind of book?
I teach the longer narrative. I teach a year-long course in writing a book because it seems to me that, especially these days, it's extremely important that we get something long enough that we can put a spine on it. Because in the MFA programs, and I'm not unfamiliar, I've taught in several wonderful MFA programs, but the emphasis is usually on the short story. And I think the reason for that is that it's I hope my professor friends will forgive me, but we're all overworked and we have a lot of students, and it's way easier to read like shorter things. Everyone needs to read shorter things. And yet the narrative, in my case, happens to be configured as a novel. I am a novelist. I was born this way. It's a big, big story, and it has all these parts to it. I really think of it, I call the book Architecture because I think of it as a house. You can come in the back door. You can ninja in down the chimney. You can attack the house. You can walk in politely, and many women do, in the front door and sit in the parlor. You can be in the bedroom. My second book was very much about what goes on in the bedroom, according to me. I wanted to write about sexuality in a very intimate way. I wanted to write very intimately. I wanted even maybe to make my reader a little bit uncomfortable, as intimacy does, and explore that. And so the novel, I can teach almost anybody to write a novel. I think poets are born. I think they're born with a beautiful voice. And if you don't have one, and I'm sorry to say I do not, I am not a poet. And every once in a while I accidentally write one, but a poem, but I'm not a poet, nor am I a short story writer. I came through an MFA program or an MA program where we were all being encouraged to write short things. Every little story of mine was like a broken novel. And that, I think, is something that's quite innate in us, that rhythm of whether the story is large or whether it's small and elegant. And I think about this a whole lot. I think it's very hard to write a very beautiful and perfect short story. I have never done so. I never will. And that those who have that particular gift are special among us. But on the other hand, storytelling is so natural to us that you give me a person and I can get a novel out of them. I know it. It doesn't take much talent. It's really the trash can of genres. We put everything in there, recipes and footnotes and everything left over from and vengeance. It's a wonderful form and it's enormous.
And more writers are writing memoir out of that same storytelling drive that really we have the material right here. And I'll say your book, The Wrong Dog Dream, at times reads like a good novel.
Ah.
And we'll get to talking about this. There were points that, to me, I was turning the page in anticipation of what was going to transpire. I want to read to you a line from your book that, to me, epitomized the book in a way and cracked me up. I mean, I hadn't been laughing out loud while reading your book, but this line made me laugh out loud. "Dog's name Chomsky," Jack told us. "Chomsky," Noah asked. "Who names their dog Chomsky?" Then he looked down at Tebow, saying, "Good dog, T." And Tebow wagged extravagantly. And I think why that made me laugh was that your dog's name was Tebow. And so why is Chomsky so ridiculous? It, to me, also epitomized your own exploration in this book of your narrative content, your story. And we all have our stories, and as you said, when you discovered that there are other people who have backgrounds that are like yours, mm-hmm. or maybe a different flavor, a different variation, and that we're all dealing with stuff.
Oh, yeah. And it feels to me like this is actually a very important task, that if we don't in some way or another get a hold of the narrative and become the subject of the sentence, especially maybe for women, especially, that we then are turned into the direct object where we feel like life happens to us and we're not the one really in charge and we're not driving the car. The vehicle has run us over somehow. And so if there's anything about which I feel sort of messianic, it is this, that we do have these stories. It is extremely important for us to tell them. And that the storytelling thing, there is no trick really to writing a novel. You just make these scenes and then you put them in the order that the story demands. And it is so simple. That's why I can teach anybody to do it. And I know that because I taught myself how to do it out of this huge morass. As you may have guessed, I don't have any problem like with writer's block. I have the other problem, which is that I have sort of the accelerated need to handle everything in language. It's what I do with trauma. And so in the case of The Wrong Dog Dream, this horror happened to us that my husband and I, we as a family had got a puppy, and he and I both obsessed about losing this dog. It was very odd because he's a very calm person and a Buddhist, and I'm anxious by nature. But he was very anxious about losing our dog also, and it was a time of great displacement. We had moved all the way across the country, and our kids were back and forth, and our kids were in California. And so we'd put all this stuff, this burden of worry, onto our dog. And we worried about leaving him in boarding, and yet we needed to because we were back and forth to California all the time, and our dog died in boarding. And the horror of exactly what each of us had worried about and happened that usually you believe, I'm, you know, an agnostic at least, and we think that if we worry about something that that sort of protects us, like works like prayer used to, but it hadn't protected our dog. And we were just blown down by this. So we did the thing that you're not supposed to do and that people got extremely mad at us for doing, which was 4 days later, our dog died on Monday, and by Saturday afternoon, we had a new dog named Wayne Tebow. And our first dog was beautiful, and our second dog is frankly funny looking, and we got him in West Virginia, and we got him from the pound. He's a West Virginia porch hound, which means long legs like a greyhound, and whatever, cross between whatever you have, they say, and whatever comes up on your porch.
In contrast to your dog that died on boarding, Whistler, that was a high-end pedigree dog.
Right.
And when a pet dies, it seems like it renders everything into the past.
Mm-hmm.
It's a demarcation.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why it feels even more so than when people die, maybe mm-hmm. because of the intimacy that we have with them. But mm-hmm. it seems that you need to start new. And it seems like you guys just did that. You did that.
Yeah, Jack knew how to do that. I mean, he knew how to get out of bed and go get in the car and drive to go get the dog. We had to talk them into giving us a dog. We were so messed up that we couldn't stay out of bed. I mean, it was really unbelievably devastating. I dealt with the deaths of both my parents. I'd watched and been with him as he dealt with the deaths, the loss of his parents. But for some reason, the purity of that loss and that it was absolute negligence and that I'd picked the kennel, and so my terrible guilt about this, you know, misjudgment of this person that we left our dog in the care of, and that it was preventable. And there was just a purity of sadness and terror and loss that really absolutely blew both of us down, which was really surprising to me because I knew I would go to bed over something. I'd go to bed over something for 3 days. But Jack, too. I mean, he also just could not manage until so we explained to the ladies at the kennel, this beautiful, really well-run no-kill facility in West Virginia where we lived in Washington, D.C., but had a place, a country place, up for the weekends. And we had to talk them into giving us this dog because if we had a dog, then we'd have to stay out of bed and go walk our dog and take care of him. So they gave us our dog for $45.
I found that in your book, it seemed like the death of Whistler was, whether you knew it at the time or not, a turning point in your own maybe view of your own life as rather than creating this life, living this life.
Uh-huh.
And as your story progresses and your new dog comes into your life and your relationship is different with that dog, you have another episode in the book, and we don't want to give too much away. I want our readers to find out a lot. And I do want to say, I was nervous knowing that you were writing about the death of Whistler, and I was almost afraid to get to that part.
Mm-hmm.
And I will tell our readers that I thought you handled it in such a way that was tasteful, tactful, and spared the readers from feeling even more grief.
Yeah. Yeah, he dies. Our dog, the book is, I'm just looking at the pages, and he dies by page 70 or something. Because really, the book is about the fact that when we have animals, chances are we're going to outlive our animals. And it is so much like, I hate the analogy, but it is so much like losing a child, and yet we must learn how to deal with loss of our animals with dignity and to honor them and what they are. I mean, birth and death are very much part of our animal natures. And so our dogs remind us constantly that, I think I said in here, what kind of, we have these domesticated animals in our lives for a very profound purpose, which is that they remind us every single day of the necessity of being alive in the ways that they are, which is not in our minds. And as a writer, I can live up there, you know, to the point where I forget to eat or ever dress or leave the house. So having a dog for me is, it's like a physical necessity. And that this research into the way our domesticated animals function, in that they hold our gaze, the cat or the dog who lives in our house looks us in the eyes in the way that an animal in the wild will not. And so it was that special animal who came to us to live at that border between us and nature. And there are link backwards, so that when I go out with my dog on the trail, he shows me how to be there in a way I can't know without my animal. He sets the pace, and he's seeing and hearing and smelling, especially, so much more than I ever will. So, yeah, I think that this matter of learning to live the day that we're given is really the lesson that my dog has for me, and also his boundless. Oh, my God, this dog is so joyful. And he was a complete accident. And he is the funniest looking dog that you would ever see. He is not the beautiful, planned, perfect dog that we went and bought and researched and all that. We just happened upon this. A friend of mine used to call them junkyard dogs. And yet he is just a magnificent creature. The other thing that a book does is it memorializes. So I always have Whistler now. You know, I have him as a little warm bundle of fur, and I have him as the neurotic little dog that, I mean, he really became a very neurotic, high-strung dog. And considering that we lived together in this house, he was living with this neurotic, sort of anxious, high-strung rider. And we'd walk out into this strange city in which we knew no one. And he would bark at anybody who looked to him at all peculiar. It was really a nightmare. I mean, he barked at people in wheelchairs. He barked at children in strollers. He didn't like little kids. He didn't like anybody who looked any bit different. If he saw a woman in a costume from Sierra Leone, he went just off his nut. And we are in the most cosmopolitan city in the nation. It was just a nightmare.
So we should tell our readers that in the book, you move from your home. I mean, you're a Bay Area native to the East Coast, to Washington, D.C., and then have a country place in West Virginia. And that's a big part of the story, too, is your life and living in these other areas. And as you move back to the Bay Area and have Tebow, your porch hound, you are dealing with creating a settled life here. And this book is very much, I think, a love story about you and your husband and the life you have together that, I don't know, maybe it took you by surprise.
That, well, it was surprising to me that I fell in love, you know. I mean, very lucky, very lucky. And I think that what happened with a childhood like mine, my dad was a suicide, my mother was crazy, really, frankly, and went to the mental hospital right after he died. And so I think that with that sort of childhood, typically you'd suffer this worry of that you'll ever be able to love anyone if you've lost those people. And I was, you know, well compensated. I was raised very well by my aunt and uncle, and I was very lucky. I was in a loving home, and was able to go ahead and go to college, and I was a hard worker and good student and all that, and I could achieve. But that piece of really being swept away by falling in love was something that I had never experienced, I think because I was just too guarded. I just couldn't allow it. You know, I couldn't lose. I couldn't bear to lose. And I think that that was the reason, really, that Jack couldn't get a dog. He'd seen his dog hit by a car when he was a little boy and couldn't bear the thought. He's very, very good at being a loving person. I would say I'm not that good. He's also a very happy person. He's talented at it. And my first dog and I are the kind that have to work at it. Our second dog is a happy dog. And so these are our talents, and we can certainly benefit by being with somebody who is better at happiness, the practice of happiness, than you happen to be.
In your memoir, you talk about hiking and physical activity. Climbing a mountain is like writing a book. All it takes is the mind trick by which you hypnotize yourself into a state that's only suspension of negative belief. And that resonated so much with me personally, and I'm sure with other people too, that sometimes presenting ourselves with that kind of challenge really edifies us to do many other things. Mm-hmm. And it is just a matter of one foot in front of the other.
Right, right. Yeah, you can climb a mountain. And that's the way it's done. I think that we in our lives think I can't do that because the concept, it's the idea of climbing the mountain. It's not the reality. The reality is that it is simply one step. And that's exactly like writing a book. That's exactly why I can get people to write a book, because I can get them to, I can trick them into writing a scene. They don't have to write a chapter, because chapter one is too hard to write anyway. You know, you don't start there. You start chapter seven anyway, but even chapters are too hard. So you just write a scene, and that's the way books are made.
Do you give writing workshops, Jan?
I do. I teach at a place called Fish Trap, and it's a beautiful writer's community in the northmost, eastmost part of Oregon. It's unbelievably remote. It takes forever to get there. But we meet in July for 7 days, and I get a batch of writing novelists or memoir. You know, I don't discriminate between the two, since I, you know, that memoir is a marketing device. Used to be the autobiographical first novel, and now it's the memoir. So, but, you know, sometimes the story doesn't know whether it wants to be a novel or it hasn't told you yet, so you don't have to have the idea. The ideas aren't necessary. You know, we can get rid of them. We just want to write this big story. And so I get, say, 8 students who begin in July. And then after that, every month, they send me 30 pages. So I trick them into writing 300 pages or more. And every month, we talk on the phone. They send me physical manuscript pages. I read them, mark them up, send them back to them. And we talk on the phone for, you know, about an hour every month. We meet in Portland in January for a long weekend check-in. My students are a collective in that they know one another and are supportive of one another, but they don't have time to work on one another's work. I don't encourage them to do so, because these books of ours or stories so early can be told to be quiet really easily. Like if somebody starts criticizing your writing, when you're just trying to tell a story, and we're all way better critics than we are writers. We haven't written, most of us haven't written a book yet, but we're really critical. And then we get around other people who believe that they're offering us benefit by also being really critical of our writing. And then we start rewriting and we haven't even written anything yet. So what I try to do is really get them to turn off the left brain critic and work, you know, it's the same technique that people learn to draw. Right.
So the writing is secondary to telling the story.
Yeah.
You have to tell the story.
Yeah. I'm just trying to get them to tell the story. Yeah.
Well, I hope some of our listeners are encouraged by that.
Yeah, I hope so too.
Yeah. because everybody does have a story to tell.
Mm-hmm.
And what's your next story?
Well, I'm working on it. I have just been invited to blog for Huffington Post. And so what I've just finished, like in the last 12 hours, is a new post that will probably go up tomorrow. It's called Shopping for Husbands. It's the second part, and it's about what was going on in Berkeley around the time that my marriage came apart, and it was in the late 80s. And what happened during that time that I found really interesting, and again, I was typical of this, but atypical also, was women were leaving their husbands. And it was so odd that I don't think that people's behavior was different. It's simply that women were leaving their husbands. The wives were leaving. And everybody was just dumbfounded. How could this happen? They were wives and mothers. And so Shopping for Husbands is a little bit about that. The accelerated female is who I call this woman who, she's like an electron, and she's sprung free of that, you know, the grounding neutron, proton nucleus, and she is free, and she is zooming around with her hair henned and, you know, that, and it was exhilarating, and I was one of them, and I was free. I'd written a novel, and I was, you know, taking off for the stratosphere, and I was in a cohort, and that's the odd thing, is every single time I think I'm doing something incredibly original, it just turns out that I am really typical of my generation. So Accelerated Females, which is the post that's going up right now on Huffington Post, is what I've been working on in the moment. In the long run, I'm working on another novel, and it's got a long and beautiful title that I can never quite remember. But do you want me to paraphrase it?
Sure.
Yeah, the title of the book is The Greater Tragedy Being When We Become Famous for What Is Only Our Saddest Story.
That sounds like it will be an interesting tale.
Thank you.
Yes. And thank you for coming in today. And I want to encourage people to read your lovely book, The Wrong Dog Dream, A True Romance. And it does speak. It speaks to me, and I think it'll speak to a lot of readers.
Thank you, Suzanne.
Jane Vandenberg's latest book is The Wrong Dog Dream. You can follow her blogs online at The Huffington Post. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, Rosemary Manchester talks with Kathleen Alcott. And Barbara Quick reviews Cheryl Strayed's book, Wild. It's KRCB's A Novel Idea.
I can see the wind blowing through the tree. I can see your eyes as they stare at me, and I don't know why, I can't help but cry, maybe something's wrong with me. I can feel the cool grass beneath my feet, I can hear you whispering something sweet, and I don't know why, you can't help but lie. Something's wrong.
at once heartbreaking and humorous, Kathleen Alcott's debut novel, The Dangers of Proximal Alphabets, has captured the imagination of readers and critics alike. Rosemary Manchester talks with Petaluma native Kathleen Alcott on her emerging career as a writer.
Kathleen, I have to tell you, it's the first time that I had to use my dictionary for one of the words in the title. It's such an interesting word, proximal.
Yeah. What I like about it is that the average reader's inclination is to say that it just means nearby, but really it refers to, it's used in relationship with distal, and it talks about the center of a system. So proximal means not just close, but near the center of something, you know, important, I'd like to believe.
Well, I know from reading the book that word choice is very important to you.
It sure is.
Your writing is intense. I was so impressed with the voice throughout the narrator's voice throughout the whole book, and I found myself confusing the narrator with the writer. Is there some part of the writer Kathleen in the character Ida?
What I will say is that the role that memory plays in Ida's life is not unlike the role memory has played in my life. I do have something of an eidetic memory, which is something Ida copes with. It's filmic in a sense, which is something I share with the character. And it, I think I've gotten better at it, but it used to overwhelm me. I used to have terrible insomnia where I would just kind of sift through images in my head, you know, related to memories. So in one way, I'm linked to that character. But I think that also what you're speaking about is just the fact that I'm probably a writer that is based in character first and primarily. It means I've done a great job for you, the reader, if you feel that we're so interconnected.
Let's talk about your characters and Ida, who is the protagonist, and then she's surrounded by the two J's, Jackson on one side and James on the other.
Yeah.
Even on the cover of the book, you see an I in the middle and a J on each side in the alphabet. So you very carefully selected those names.
I did. I do remember that it was always James and Jackson, but the main character didn't have a name at first because, you know, it was told from the first person. In a very, very early chapter that I wrote years before I really wrote this book, it was in the third person, and it, you know, but that was never correct. I think that I came to the first person because there needed to be those questions that arrive from a first person telling of the story, which is, have I gotten this correct? And is this how these events really occurred? And am I right to weight them in the way that I do?
And only a character writing in the first person would have access to all the background information and the interior monologue that goes on. So you were almost forced into a first person narration.
Sure. And then just to go back to the name, I think that Ida, one thing that she suffers from is that she sort of feels like she's just the historian who has recorded all of this, and that maybe this isn't even her story. You know, she feels like she's been fascinated by these brothers and the way that they talk in their sleep, and trying to fit herself into their bloodline since childhood. And so maybe in some ways she feels like her name is important. Later in the book, she remembers. She talks about it more. She says, it's not just myself that calls me I. There are three of us, because both James and Jackson refer to her as I, as shorthand for Ida.
Mm-hmm. Let's give the listeners a few clues about who Jackson and James are and who Ida is. There are two families.
Sure.
Ida and her dad.
Mm-hmm.
And then James and Jackson and their mom.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very close.
They are. They grew up down the street from one another. And they, you know, Ida and Jackson are the oldest. They're slightly older than James. And they meet when they're tiny babies. And shortly thereafter, their respective, you know, Ida's mother and Jackson's father both die. And so, you know, they both suddenly hail from single-parent households.
Mm-hmm. And you grew up in Petaluma.
I did.
And Petaluma is the setting of the story, isn't it?
Well, it's certainly the frame for their childhood. I mean, later they're in San Francisco, which I believe is just important to the story as the frame of Petaluma. I will say, though, that, and I think a lot of novelists would tell you the same, that it's important that you're able to bend a location to your means. And so the town in the book is only Petaluma in as much as it made sense for the story, and in other ways it's not. I mean, the Petaluma that I was just saying, I was in Petaluma today for the first time, any serious time spent there in a couple of years, and it's, you know, almost unrecognizable to me. Petaluma now would not function in the same way that it does in this. There's no ghost of industry anymore, which I feel like is kind of a force in this book, and, you know, the recreation of a town and its re-ideation of itself is important.
But the old mill is still there, and the canal is – no, it's not the estuary.
The river.
River, yes, right.
That part in the book, though, is true, that the town got together and they got some official or something or other to come in and say, this is a river, not an estuary, which I think is hilarious.
It is.
Because we go – I mean, people go around and they're so snotty about it, but it's a filthy, filthy body of water.
Yes, it is.
I mean, I've had friends swim in it, and you get a rash. You do not want to go into that river.
But I'd be interested to know how it seemed to come back to Petaluma.
I mean, it is a place that's cloaked in memory – for me, and so because of that, it's sort of jarring to walk by and see a wine shop suddenly in a place where you remembered another store. But there are some strongholds. Shutterbug is still there, that camera shop. That kind of broke my heart in a beautiful way today. I can't believe that store is still there.
Yeah. Now, did you go to elementary school there?
I did. I went to McNair Elementary School on the west side, which I think any Petaluman will tell you is the real side of Petaluma.
Yeah. And only those of us in Sonoma County will be so fascinated with the idea of Petaluma. I know that you live on the East Coast now.
It was a fantastic place to grow up. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the walkability of it was very important for me as a child. And I think, it let me and also my peers develop a sense of autonomy when it's okay for you to walk down to the store and return home. I think that you start to get a better idea of yourself as a person earlier on than maybe if you have to have your parents driving you. But I have no idea. You know, I didn't grow up in a place where I had to be driven everywhere.
When you were living in Petaluma, did you have thoughts then of someday being a writer?
Sure, I did.
One of the
ways, actually, that I am similar to Ida is that both my parents were writers at one point in their life. My father was a journalist, and my mother was, too. And so, you know, that idea was always in my head, only insofar as I think what I have that people who didn't have parents as writers have is that I saw what it meant to sit down at a desk and work, and I heard the sounds of a typewriter, and I liked them, you know? And so I could believe that was something people would do. So maybe it was, you know, it wasn't as long of a distance for me to travel to see myself in that position.
Yes, but you were, I'm not sure what age you were when you left. I wondered if you studied writing in Petaluma or if that came later.
Oh, no, not in any formal sense. I mean, I left town when I was 17 to go to college, you know, typical age. Any studying I did in Petaluma was largely informal. I guess I had some great English teachers in high school who maybe urged me on. Kylie Cicchini, Bobbin Tobin.
Yeah, and I noticed some of your writing techniques were I was so interested in when you're introducing the book in the chapter that comes after the one that you just read, and you begin to introduce your characters, I noticed that you did it in great detail with short sentences, and it was almost like pow, pow, pow. And that is such an effective way, when it's done well, to impress upon the reader the importance of what you're reading.
I'm so glad to hear that. The prose in that chapter is much choppier than the rest of the work.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's how we come to understand people, you know, and especially after they've left us, as Jackson has left Ida, then we have all these facts that kind of rush at us at once, and we're no longer able to unite them and make sense of that person when they're not in front of us anymore.
Yes.
And so I think that was probably the drive behind that passage.
For me, it really worked because it set the stage for the intensity of the material to come. I always think of Petaluma as such a nice, safe place to grow up, but if indeed Petaluma is the setting in which the story takes place, those three kids, Ida, Jackson, and James, had a wild life. they did so many dangerous things. Well, they climbed up on top of the mill at
sure.
one point.
Well, I will tell you that I did that.
Oh, no. I was afraid to ask.
Many of those things I have done that appear in that book.
Was that an unusual thing, or did a lot of kids do it?
Well, I think there was maybe a certain breed who was drawn to that rusty ladder. but there were, when I was growing up there, and maybe it's still present there, but it's definitely faded. You know, it was like there would be these abandoned warehouses, these places where great agency once took place that were just yours to explore. There were railroad trestles that trains no longer passed on that were ours to walk over. You know, it felt like a gift in a way because, you know, when you're a child and an adolescent, what do you want but some time alone? That's all you want.
One of the things that takes place in the book that was of particular interest, I'm not sure I'd come across it much in reading, is that the two brothers, Jackson and James, not only talk in their sleep, but walk in their sleep and roam around Petaluma in that state. That's so scary to think of.
I will say that the whole book started with the one image, which was the two brothers talking in their sleep and Ida below hearing
yes.
them for mm-hmm. whatever reason. Yeah. I'm a sleep talker, and so I think I was always fascinated by it. And from that, it kind of just birthed naturally. I've always enjoyed stories about sleepwalking and been kind of horrified by them. And I did, you know, I did a smattering of research, and it was kind of charming and spotty, and really most people stop by the time they're, you know, around 12, and not that much attention is paid to it. And it just seemed like a great place to play. As a prose writer, sleepwalking was something that, you know, let me kind of convene with my characters in a way maybe I wouldn't have gotten to otherwise.
And Jackson, in his sleep, creates works of art.
Yes, he does.
That was a fascinating jump from sleepwalking to sleep painting.
What I really liked about that is that it mostly stemmed from, you know, Ida just loves this person fiercely
yes.
and without question.
Yes.
And he does these really pretty disturbing things in his sleep. He grabs her. She bruises. He holds her so hard. He walks around their house destroying things as a sleepwalker. And so she decides, I can find a way to love this too and make this beautiful, which is insane. It's an insane thing for her to do. And so she starts handing him these materials. But, you know, in a way, that's an allegory for, you know, just how we try to love people in general. Like, I think anyone in a romantic relationship looking back on it might tell you that they found a way to adore the things about someone that are not endearing because they felt like they didn't have a choice.
And Jackson is very offended at the idea of other people seeing his works of art.
Sure, because he feels like he doesn't own it, and because he feels like Ida is celebrating this part of himself that he's never been proud of.
Does he remember creating those?
He doesn't. That was one of the hardest passages to write, actually, was him waking up and kind of tracing his hands over these works of art and wanting to connect with them and waiting for the synapses to fire, the neural pathway to light up, and nothing happening. And then he tries to recreate them. He's like, well, if I can make these beautiful things while I'm sleeping, then gosh darn it, I should be able to do that at the kitchen table. And he just can't. And it's, you know, it's heartbreaking.
Yeah, and that's probably an allegory, too, that he cannot create them when he's awake. Only in his sleeping condition. But he, I think one of the big crises of the book is when Ida wants her friend Paul, who has a gallery, to show the paintings because she feels that they are so amazing and so outstanding that the public deserves to see them.
Sure.
And Jackson doesn't share that that desire to for the world to see his work.
No. The conceit is that she believes the public should see them, right? But I
yes.
really think that more has to do with Ida wanting to celebrate something that shouldn't be celebrated because she feels like it's just her job to love this person. You know, it has been since she was a tiny infant, and it will be, she thinks, until she dies.
Yeah. It occurs to me that this is a book that will be interesting not only to adults but to the so-called young adults. You know, we talk a lot about the categories of literature. Is it adult reading? But I think it would be of great interest to high school students, and as well as to mature people and even older people like me.
I don't think it's totally the author's job to decide who will best enjoy this book. I did write this book for adults and with adults in mind, and, you know, in thinking about the adult weight of memory of the lives that have preceded us, you know, the versions of us that we choose to ignore or listen to as we lead our lives now.
But yeah.
You know, if anyone enjoys it, then I'm happy for it.
I think a lot of people are going to enjoy this book. Let me remind our listeners of the name of the book. It's called The Dangers of Proximal Alphabets, and the author is Kathleen Alcott. Now, this isn't your first publication. I noticed that you have things in journals, but it is your first full-length novel, right?
Sure.
What's that like?
I think I did things a little bit backwards, in that most people, I think, start publishing in a lot of journals before they really aim to set out and get representation. But what I did is I had published just a little bit, and I ended up lining up with my agent, and then decided to really commit myself to writing this book, and then we sold it. And, you know, during that time, I was also working on shorter pieces and placing them so that there would be more available once the book came to shelves.
But you've had fabulous success with the book, and how does that feel?
You know, people ask me that, and especially they go, "Oh, well, you're very young, so how does it feel to have published a book so young?" And I can't really tell you, because I've never published a book at a later age. It feels like something that
good point.
You know, it feels like something that I worked for.
Yes.
If I'm young on paper, maybe I'm older in other ways, and I'm just looking forward to continuing to work and becoming a better writer. The incredible thing about being an artist in really any field is that you can see yourself getting better. The way that I'm writing now is incredibly different from the way I was writing. I mean, not incredibly. You wouldn't think that I was a different person, but I've evolved in just since I finished this book 2 years ago. And so it's awe-inspiring, really. I'm not saying that everything that I write is brilliant, but I just mean in watching yourself change is lovely.
Kathleen, you probably don't have that much time to read, but when you do read, what appeals to you?
I do try to keep up with what is being written today. I think especially as an author who's trying to, you know, to support herself that way, it's important you support other authors. This year I read a book called Arcadia by a woman named Lauren Groff that was incredible. It was just this really tragic spectacle about the downfall of a commune in upstate New York, told kind of through the growing and changing lens of a character who's born on the on the commune and ages there. And Amanda Copeland's The Orchardist, which was a pretty like sweeping historical novel that came out about 3 months ago, and I don't think has gotten enough of a spark. It was incredibly moving and stunning.
And Kathleen, it was such a pleasure to have you in the studio today, and to talk about your work. It's really a remarkable piece of work that you've done here, and I know we look forward to much more writing from you as the as your career continues to develop.
Well, I was so touched to be here. I think you paid it remarkable attention. Thank you so much for having me.
Come back again.
I will.
It's hiking season, but you don't have to be a backpacker to enjoy Cheryl Strayed's memoir of her physical and emotional journey on the Pacific Crest Trail. Here's Barbara Quick's review.
I'm truly in awe of Cheryl Strayed, author of Wild, From Lost to Found on the Pacific Crest Trail. This best-selling, Oprah-picked, heartbreaking, laugh-out-loud memoir deserves every word of praise it's garnering. Also known as the kick-ass internet advice columnist Dear Sugar, Cheryl Strayed is one of the most luminously honest and emotionally generous writers I've ever encountered. Growing up poor, abandoned by an abusive father, the author was nonetheless graced by a mother who loved her children unstintingly, managing to give them lofty goals and a moral compass despite the chaos of their lives. When her mother was diagnosed with cancer and died within the space of several months, the 22-year-old budding author went to pieces. Strayed invented the aptness of her pen name in the years immediately following her mother's death. She mired herself and her young, beloved husband in an obsessive binge of sluttiness. She started using heroin. She did everything she could to screw up her life now that her mother was no longer in this world. She saved herself and nearly killed herself in the process by undertaking an epic backpacking journey. Getting hodgepodge advice from sales clerks at REI and squirreling away the tips she got as a waitress, she outfitted herself for a solo trip of 1,100 miles from the parched peaks of the Mojave Desert to the snowdrifts of the Washington-Oregon border. In her ignorance and enthusiasm, Strayed prepared a pack that was too heavy for her to move, to say nothing of hoisting it onto her back and schlepping it for over 1,000 miles. Fortunately for us, the author took the time and care to distill her experience over the space of 20 years, all the while honing her craft as a writer and healing the hole in her heart. There's one basic message in Wild, and in all the Dear Sugar columns as well, that every single one of us has a great big hole in our heart. And our job, if we're brave and true, is to hoist our wounds up on our backs and carry them with us through life as gracefully as we can, even if we're staggering under their weight. Wild is a welcome tribute to our weakness and wounds. This is Barbara Quick for A Novel Idea.
Barbara Quick is the author of Vivaldi's Virgins and A Golden Web. Thanks for listening today. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcasts at krcb.org and listen anytime to A Novel Idea through iTunes. Music in today's show was performed by Yo-Yo Ma and Sarah Jackson-Holman. We've had production assistance from Sean Knight. I'm Suzanne Lang.
And I'm Rosemary Manchester. And remember, there's no such thing as too many books.